Good morning and welcome to Backchat. I'm Hugh Chiverton, your co-host today, Danny Gittings. Danny, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And we're talking today about what effect the protests are having on the local economy. The business sector has pointed out that retail and tourism has plunged here, with the biggest downturn in tourists since SARS. So what are the implications of that? What's the impact on the financial world, including the Hang Seng? What about rental and property prices? How should the government act to mitigate the impact? Are weaknesses in our economy being revealed? Will this lead to a long-term or even terminal decline for Hong Kong? Will Shenzhen step in and take our place? Let us know your thoughts. You can leave a message on our Facebook page, Backchat on RTHK Radio 3. You can email us, backchat@rthk.hk, but emails may be edited for length, or give us a call on 233 88266, which is our preferred option, because then you can talk directly to our guests, and we won't edit you. 233 88266. Joining us for the discussion this morning, we have David Webb, a shareholder activist, founder of website.com, and Mark Michelson, who's the chairman of Asia CEO Forum at IMA Asia. We will get to the money bit in just a moment, but as is the routine now, we've got quite a few emails on differing topics, and some many relating to our discussion yesterday with Neeru Vitacci and Claudia Moe. About fake news and rumours. First of all, let's just pick on something topical, an email that's just come in. This is from Phil, while it's fresh in our minds. Phil says, I am unable to contain myself this morning after listening to your Hong Kong Today programme. There was a segment given to one of your reporters who reported about a group of protesters who sought refuge in a Tung Chung housing estate after they had caused chaos at the airport. Phil says, this is crap reporting and nobody is interested. Surely RTHK has better stories to cover. It's pathetic that your supervisors allow such uninteresting reports to be on what is normally a good program. To set a balanced reporting, you would be better conducting a story about the police officers who have to deal with these protests, working 12 to 14 hours a day, having limited rest and sleep time, eating their food from rice boxes, and unable to spend any quality time with their family and friends. This would reflect a balanced view. Shame on you, RTHK. Let's just have real news reported and stop trying to sensationalise the situation. Let's hope tonight can be peaceful. Mid-autumn is one of the most important festivals, so let's all hope we can respect such. That comes from Phil. Comment then from emails from yesterday and overnight related to that discussion yesterday. Umesh says, that Mo woman is such a prude. This is Claudia Mo. It was nice to hear a burst of humour by Nuri with all the fake rubbish going around recently. It was also very nice of him to call out a lot of the fake news she's been blurting out, and now she claims people misunderstood her. Toby says, again, Claudia says that maybe the undercover cops threw petrol bombs without any of evidence, speaking complete nonsense again. Ling says, as a former journalist, Claudia Moe's command of English is surprisingly poor. In response to Miko's question about violence, she says that she does not condone the violence. Does she actually understand the difference between condone and condemn? By simply not condoning the violence, she is simply saying that she doesn't accept it. That's very different from condemning the behaviour of those thugs. Michael says, regarding fake news, can Nuri comment on the story that it was a policeman from Canton inserted in the Hong Kong police who shot the girl at point-blank range? Nuri has a disagreeable style, which works okay on paper, but which is horrible in speech. His attack on Miss Mo was sad and ignorant. Yolanda says, I'd like to ask Claudia Mo, I only heard her condemning the government and the police using excessive force, but I never heard her condemning the unlawful acts such as vandalised legislatures, damaged properties of MTR, damaged properties on roads, attacked police by sharp objects and bricks, threw petrol bombs, set fire on roads, stopped travellers to get on plane, stopped MTR normal operation by stopping doors closed, blocked main roads, attacked people with different voice, etc., etc. Please give the reason why, and does she at this moment still stand on the side of those radical, violent protesters? We got more than enough social unrest. O-Source says there's a rumour going round that Nuri Vitacci is a writer and informed social commentator who invented this patently incorrect fake news. Peter says, so why did the protesters smash up Tung Chung MTR and some others? There was no provocation. They're just being violent for the sake of it. Elliot says, Thursday's backchat on fake news and rumours actually showed how easily fake news can happen, even when what people are saying is true. Early in the show, Claude Jordia made the point that the Bar Association had raised issues about the extradition bill. Nouri, claiming to be a numbers guy, stated that the Bar Association only represents 1,600 lawyers and that there are another 11,000 lawyers it does not represent. His statement is factually correct, but what he implied, that the other 11,000 lawyers do not have issues with the bill, is false. The full picture is that the Law Society, which represents those, other 11,226 lawyers, has also raised concerns about the extradition bill. He also forgot to mention the legal sector marched against the bill on the 6th of June, only the fifth legal sector march since the handover. That's how easy it is to give a false impression by only stating half the truth. Beat says, it seems that Hong Kong was warned in 2013 that monster parents might be raising children to become narcissists. And he quotes a test of some 10,000 students from 2013 with a South China Morning Post story. And in that, an associate professor at City U said that, quote, Hong Kong children rated themselves a lot more highly than youngsters in the West, to an extent that some are at risk of developing orders that could turn them into violent offenders, unquote. Fast forward to 2019, many radical protesters, including school and university students, seem to have lost their moral bearing, fighting police with firebombs, slingshots and sharpened metal pipes, blocking roads, vandalising government buildings, besieging numerous police stations with multiple youngsters caught shamelessly manhandling an elderly man and other passengers at the airport. Given all the problems we now face, it might be interesting to invite Miss Annice Fung, that was the academic, to your show if she or her colleagues have engaged in more recent studies on this issue and will be able to share their findings with listeners. David says, increasing odious and invidious interference by the Chinese state media in Hong Kong affairs is causing immeasurable damage. Vicious attacks on Hong Kong citizens and the labelling of four democratic leaders, including Anson Chan, as the Gang of Four is deplorable. And yet Carrie Lam has not done or said anything. If the Hong Kong government is to restore a modicum of credibility, it must now make it absolutely clear to the Chinese authorities that such unethical journalism will not be tolerated. Failure to do so will incite further unrest and street protests and provide the US Congress with further evidence to invoke the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act. Nick says, universal suffrage equals one person has a vote, which we already have. So what is this new term your panellists quote? Full universal suffrage. Universal suffrage, nothing more, nothing less. Finally, some comments from Drake. I'm not sure if I read some of this out earlier, Drake, because there's three comments now. Drake says, anyway, please stop the quibble on who is the minority. If a person chooses to be blind in an ivory tower, just let him be. The extradition bill is a big move. There should be a thorough consultation. How can we trust the government? Still is refusing to meet with the Bar Association to be of any goodwill rushing through this bill. There are other ways to solve the murder case. Extraterritorial jurisdiction is one. Secretary of Justice keeps saying there would be a retrospective issue. Tell me, in the past 100 years, is there anywhere on earth that murder is not a serious offence? If there's no such place, then there's no retrospective issue, and extraterritorial jurisdiction is viable. He says, P.S., once this extradition backdoor is opened, the People's Congress would be able to amend it arbitrarily through Annex 3 of the Basic Law. Finally, the Secretary of Justice keeps saying that introducing extraterritorial jurisdiction that's covered in the first comment there, I think. So thank you very much indeed, everyone. Yeah, Dan.
And on our Facebook page, back chat on RTHK Radio 3, listeners commenting on the topic that we're discussing today, the economic impact of the protests. Dean says, I was observing friends in the rental market lamenting that they had only just signed a new rental agreement. They wish they hadn't, as it would have been cheaper and a better deal to be in a hotel. I remember back in the day where that was doable in Shenzhen, but now it's happening in Hong Kong. Wow. My children were born in the SAR, have been wanting to come back. Even with the cheap prices, it's a challenging choice to make with the craziness. The only thing helping push the decision along is, come now, maybe later it will be even worse. Victoria says, the saddest thing about all of this is that the protesters, who are primarily grassroots, will be the ones who suffer economically. The tycoons and the wealthy won't be affected much. One of the well-known local restaurant chains is closing down, but it's just going to reincarnate itself into four different restaurants with new names to avoid the boycott. Right now, in my neighbourhood, I am seeing units up for rent that were rarely available before. But the rent hasn't dropped. In fact, they're being revalued upwards. More friends are planning on leaving, but no one is actually packing up. Everyone recognizes that this is just truly the beginning of the end. So leaving in, say, 3 to 5 years, when the erosion of law and order, freedom of speech, is complete. And responding to Victoria's comment, Andrew says, well, the only tourists missing are mainlanders, not being allowed to visit here unless they find out the truth. So whose fault is that? Thank you very much for those comments. And indeed, there are further comments back and forth from listeners on Backchat RTHK Radio 3. So you're welcome to go to our Facebook page and join in the comments in discussion there. Let's go to our guest now, Mark Michelson. Good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Danny.
Okay. So how do you assess the economic impact? I mean, we've seen some listeners referring there to restaurants closing, hotels cutting their prices in half, Cafe Pacific planes almost empty.
Well, clearly, these things have happened, but what I hear a lot is the uncertainty involved with all of this. No one sees a clear end game in what's happening now, and that's been reflected, I think, by the comments. And that's obviously making a lot of, I think, local companies and international companies nervous. And so I think this adds to the problems. Hong Kong already was slowing, and I think David might elaborate on this, but it's already slowing, not just because of the protests. Obviously, we have a little trade problem between the U.S. and China. Economies have been slowing down around the world and in the region, and including China. And a lot of this has been affecting Hong Kong already. So we're in below the single digits now in terms of growth, and it may even go a bit lower, and this is starting to affect people.
We're hearing a lot of anecdotal stories about individual families leaving. Are you hearing any stories about companies relocating?
But, I chair a group, as you know, of regional CEOs, multinational companies, and none of them have said that they are, but they all have contingency plans. And so in some sense, some of the staff may be leaving, and that's the worry, really. They worry about the people who work with them and what they're going to do. You know, some of them are Hong Kongers, some of them are from elsewhere, but if they have alternatives, and especially if they're working for an international company, they might be able to move in other places where that international company is located. So I don't get any indication, and it's a very small sample, that it's happening to any extent yet, but obviously it could.
Oh, yeah, Hong Kong's been through so much, right? Yeah. SARS, you've been here for so long, SARS, yeah, so many other. How do you rate what we're seeing at the moment compared with other economic downturns in terms of severity?
I mean, and a lot of my friends, and, you know, everybody has their personal opinion, think this is the most difficult in many ways. And
worse than SARS.
Well, in a way, I mean, SARS was terrible in the sense that we didn't know what was going to happen. But there were some criticisms of the government, but it wasn't so much the government that was sort of on the other side of the those who were raising questions. You know, now it is, and again, I think the uncertainty really is contributing to this to a great extent. And it's overall, it's not just what's going on in Hong Kong, but, you know, it's around the world, which obviously affects Hong Kong, a very externally oriented economy.
Isn't this? I was just wondering if this is starting to have a longer term impact. I'm just thinking, like, here in RTHK, you know, we're looking to for organizing things for Christmas, and you're thinking, well, we've got to have a contingency plan, and then, because, you know, you've got to make arrangements, then do you go to plan B now because you've got to start early? And then in the new year, you know, do we have to sort of start activating? So if you've got to start thinking ahead, you've got to start planning ahead, you might have to think, well, maybe we won't have this conference here. We'll go somewhere else instead, you know, and then things start shifting away from Hong Kong.
And that's happening already. It's happening with companies. It's happening there are a couple of student groups that were supposed to come in January that have canceled their trip because they had to make the decision now. You know, maybe that was premature, but, you know, I guess this is from overseas.
So yeah, maybe it is, but you don't know, and you've got to sort of.
But then there are other businesses here that have been here that are taking advantage of inviting some of their fellow members of their company here, because obviously rooms are cheaper, conference rooms are cheaper, et cetera. So, you know, in some ways, and those that are living here don't feel that it's really a dangerous place, even though there are a lot of issues.
No, I think you're right. I mean, it's not generally a dangerous place for ordinary people, is it? You could say it's a very interesting place. I don't know if you could even sell it as a...
problem, though, is if you're sitting in London watching the BBC News or indeed in the US, you don't see the everyday life, do you? I mean, the news understandably reports the confrontations, and then people do worry about visiting Hong Kong.
No, absolutely. And a lot of companies, of course, have very strong security arms that are very careful about where they send people.
But retail and catering, tourism, hotels... all these businesses, they must be taking quite a hit.
Yeah.
And of course, they employ a lot of people, don't they?
Clearly. And, you know, and also in terms of people's everyday life, when I talk to people at the university or elsewhere, you know, they say they don't know where to go on weekends, especially on weekends, because they don't know where they can go and how they can go, which is a different situation than they've been in before, I guess.
David Webb, you were here during SARS as well. Is this worse than SARS?
I think it's yes. That's certainly the case, because SARS only lasted for a few weeks in terms of uncertainty over whether there would be a global epidemic. Sure. If there was going to be a global epidemic, then there was no point in leaving Hong Kong. You were going to be in another infected
place. But it did
freeze.
I mean, people were scared to go on the streets, weren't they? I mean, in the way that
not really. No, I mean, I that was when I launched in 2003 my Project Pole AGM blitz, and I went to all the AGMs of the Hang Seng Index companies, and some of them were handing out face masks at the door, but people were still coming to AGMs. There was some, as you recall, some quarantine of one particular block because they had a large number of infected people in it. It wasn't devastating. And back to Mark's point, that was not something caused by the government, whereas this episode is. And so was the national security proposal of 2003, and so was the national curriculum proposal of 2012, and so was
the
restricted universal suffrage proposals of 2014. Each of the four major protest incidents since 2003, inclusive, has been triggered by the government.
But earlier ones didn't have even Occupy in 2014 had very minimal effect on the economy.
So the government
can make mistakes, and it doesn't actually have an economic impact.
It has a sort of cumulative effect on the potential for unrest. It's a sort of, you know, layering up the issues. I think there's greater recognition amongst the public than ever before that we have a democratic deficit, that they don't elect their leader, and the policies that flow from that are not theirs. They're not ones that they voted for. Setting aside the transient issue of violence, a very small minority of extremist protesters, and also the questions around policing of them, I think those are minor transient issues compared to the big picture issue, which is, are we going to tip towards democracy with civil liberties or authoritarianism without them? Because there's only one place on earth I know of right now that tries to combine civil liberties with no democracy, and that's Hong Kong. It's an inherently unstable equilibrium.
It worked for a long time, didn't it?
And it's worked for, not in historical terms very long, but it's survived 22 years despite these four tests over that period, because people have always thought that the status quo was a better option than really pushing for change. And I think now the Beijing and Hong Kong government need to make that choice and either have an authoritarian crackdown, which would certainly change our way of life here, and the inverse McCarthyism that would flow from that in terms of hunting out non-party supporters. We've already seen the beginning of that with Cathay Pacific and the departure of Rupert Hogg. There's one CEO who's leaving Hong Kong, I think. That's the draconian outcome. Alternatively, Beijing could suddenly wake up and realize that Hong Kong could be a very harmonious and prosperous place if they allowed it to have its own local democracy. But I don't think that we're going to be able to get past this conflagration of protest, with nearly 2 million people on the street at one point, without making that choice. It's something that the government really has to... in Beijing has to decide upon.
Now, if we move into a long, it is possible we will move into a long term model where these protests of some form continue for months or even years to come, and then the economy will have to adjust, won't it?
Well, that's in Carrie Lam's famous Reuters speech, if I can call it that, to the, which I think we all know is to the Vision 2047 Foundation, which makes me wonder if, Mark, were you at that lunch? Because you're a member, aren't you?
Yes. You weren't the one who took the tape recorder, Mark.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure what happened. And there's some controversy over whether it was that one or was another one.
But anyway, if you were there, you would recognize the recording. But anyway,
were you at the lunch, Mark?
I was there. But I'm not sure if it's the same one or not.
Maybe you weren't listening.
It was a little different than I think, but it may have been.
Anyway,
Thank you for that elucidation, David Webb.
Sorry, what was I saying? I've lost my thread.
We're talking about if we move into a long-term
right.
Model
so she said she thought that China was willing to play the long game and just wait it out, which was the strategy in 2014 when she was chief secretary, and she even met some students at one point, nearly all of whom have now been either arrested or denied their electoral rights as candidates. They did wait it out until. People got bored with this, with the occupation, and eventually they used the courts to get injunction orders from minibus companies to get them off the streets. I don't think they can wait it out this time. There will just be bigger and bigger peaceful protests. I expect there'll be a very large one on the 1st of October. And if the police deny that approval for an organized assembly, there'll be a very large unauthorized assembly. So they can't really go on pushing this, kicking this can down the road. I think they'll need to.
Well, maybe
make some
they
hard
won't.
Choices.
I mean, but maybe that's the best option. I'm just thinking, like with Cathay, I mean, they can snap their fingers and have a very big impact, can't they? In
Beijing,
in
yes.
Beijing. On
yes,
the
business, they can.
On the way business.
And it will create a brain drain effect, a net brain drain. It'll discourage people from bringing their talents to Hong Kong.
Yeah.
I mean, when you asked if companies are leaving,
well,
companies don't
that
generally
means,
leave
that means
whole, wholesale.
That means there are problems. I mean...
Sure, yeah. They don't leave wholesale, but people won't agree to transfer into Hong Kong, and some executives will want to leave. Their families will say, "We've had enough of this. It's all getting too difficult. I want to get my kids back into the home country schools or whatever." And also locals, I think, with foreign passports, and there's probably a million people here who have a passport in their drawer that's not a Chinese passport.
One of our listeners was just saying, I'm sure you're aware of the sentiment around town. A lot of people are talking about leaving, but we actually seem very little sign of people actually
doing
that.
Because we still don't know how this is going to play out. It's only been 3 months, and you don't make a moving decision normally within such a short period. There's a lag effect. But, if there is a crackdown and there's a hunt for anyone who is sympathetic to the protests on their Facebook pages, which have already been collected, if you've had an open Facebook page, it's too late to close it. If they start going after people for their sympathies, purging the civil service like Erdogan did in Turkey after the failed coup against him, for example, then obviously that's going to have a great chilling effect on the talent pool. And we're a 70 or 80% service economy. We don't actually make very much stuff here.
But how about not a crackdown, but things just continue as they are? Maybe individual companies like Cathay, there are crackdowns, but things just continue, and this becomes the new normal with violent protests at the weekend, but Hong Kong pretty much functioning normally the rest of the time.
So just cancel weekends, basically.
Well, the weekends are not cancelled. You just have to.
Yes,
you move around slightly. I'm sure you were moving around last weekend, David. Wherever I was, despite road closures, you just factor them in.
Yes, and you try not to book a flight that leaves on a Saturday or a Sunday
You get used to not being able to go into the departure hall at the airport.
Because
these kind of things.
They've actually produced. Effective non-protest method now, where they just on their chat groups they talk about blockading the airport, and then the police do it for them. Basically, they reduced the airport express service to one station, Hong Kong station, direct, and it didn't. Basically, very few people turned up for that.
So we've only got about a minute before the news, but that's my question. What if that becomes the new normal? Hong Kong adapts like any other economy or society adapts, and life would continue. It's a slightly different sort of life, but it's not a disastrous life.
And then what? How long? How long would that go on for, Danny, before
I'm asking the question.
And larger protests happen?
You don't see it as sustainable over the long term, is what you're saying.
No, and I think in some ways, if they would just make a choice and live with it, things would be better. Maybe we'd have a calm authoritarian situation, a bit like Singapore, but the problem being that the tycoons still elect the government, whereas in Singapore, they don't have the tycoons directing their policies.
Okay. Okay, an email from XC, Xiao Chang, just before the news. Another collection of neoliberals in your studio, never a mention of the R word. It's a revolution, dears. Underlying your studio guest bleats and squeaks is the assumption that capitalism is the natural system to run the world. How wrong can you be? The squeaking of mice discovering that their cheese has moved. Let me tell you about the end game to dispel your panel's uncertainty. The people have begun to reclaim their lives and exercise their power. The momentum is unstoppable. If you have any money, shift it. There is no more easy cheese. The people are seizing all the milk churns. And stop squeaking, please. Thanks very much. The weather before the news at 9 o'clock. Very hot and dry with some sunny periods. Maximum temperature 34 degrees. The outlook cloudy with a few showers and thunderstorms at the weekend. There's a very hot weather warning now, and the yellow fire danger warning is in force. And the reading's 29 Celsius with relative humidity now at 81%. Back in 3 minutes' time. Welcome back. Back chat this Friday morning with Danny Gittings and me, Hugh Chiverton. We're talking with Mark Michelson and David Webb this morning about the economic impact of the protests. And we're going to talk maybe a little bit more now about property, perhaps, and about the stock market, and also what the government might do by way of mitigation. Your thoughts, please. You can leave a message on our Facebook page, Backchat and RTHK Radio 3. You can email backchat@rthk.hk, or just pick up the phone, give us a call, join the conversation. The number is 233-88266. We'd love to hear from you. 233-88266 is the number. Okay, some emails. First of all, a few related to other issues. Din says, Claudia Moe's revelations prompting a revision from the ambulance service reported in the RTHK News, and there's a couple of links there. Quote, the fire services department say police repeatedly told them that there were no casualties inside Prince Edward MTR station on August the 31st, even though there were several injured people inside, and it took an hour for ambulance personnel to get permission to attend to those hurt, unquote. How long were they treated inside Prince Edward MTR, and how long did it take from there before they arrived at A&E? This is an extremely serious allegation which must be investigated by IPCC. In addition to the Yuen Long incident, CCTV from inside Prince Edward MTR, the special evacuation train, and LCK MTR, plus private CCTV media coverage of outside both stations, like of ambulance crews waiting, must be secured and studied. Perhaps RTHK can do this, as it did for Yuen Long. That comes from Din. Alan says, dear Backchat, if the Hong Kong government continues to remove the two systems in favour of one country, then indeed Hong Kong will have no advantages to offer over Shenzhen, and business will be just selling milk powder and real estate to mainlanders, at least while it has the tax advantages, which could be withdrawn at any time. While the milk powder and Rolex vendors no doubt feel pain, the rest of Hong Kong might prefer some shops that catered to them. An economy based on reselling stuff we don't make is parasitic and low margin. Hong Kong needs real, high-skilled jobs that give a living wage so people can get ahead. Instead of pouring $1 trillion into the harbour to make a new island, Hong Kong should invest in education and real jobs. Australia, for instance, has created a big education industry, offering world-class education to many Chinese. Why can't Hong Kong do that? But Hong Kong keeps doing projects like Cyberport and technology parks, real estate developments in everything but name. That's from Alan. Joe says, Hong Kong can lose a few million people. This will mean there are more places for the locals to live. Less construction, less pollution. It would be good to get back to the days of chunking mansions when you had tourists from all over the world bringing different skills and businesses to Hong Kong, and we had cheap accommodation, not corporate accommodation, and hotels in it for the greed of sucking from the wealthy. It would be productive to start remanufacturing in Hong Kong. And don't forget Chinese New Year, the yearly cycle of all the businesses in China closing down and restarting up again. Surely China doesn't want to close down Hong Kong so that everybody has to use the road to nowhere to the China Economic Zone. And don't forget now Donald has opened his mouth, China visas are more expensive. That comes from Joe. And finally, Fergus says, as regards Hong Kong's economic outlook, one angle needs further discussion. The current situation has exposed China's sinister hand in demanding patriotism from corporations and punishing those corporate deviants, in inverted commas, who fail to control staff politically. Beijing's manipulative need for companies demonstrating a love for the motherland is a worrying threat to business. Warnings to Cathay Pacific and the fallout there is only the proverbial tip of the iceberg. Where does this sit with the fallacy of one country, two systems? And it's also a fallacy that Hong Kong is a free economy as it likes to crow. China's hand in controlling business goes back to pre-1997 when it froze Jardine out of the CT9, Container Terminal 9 bid. Those thoughts from Fergus. Thanks very much.
Mark Michelson, let's pick up on that last comment.
Yeah, I was about to talk about it anyway.
Well, please go ahead then. I mean, do other businesses you're in contact with, do they fear that what happened to Cafe could happen to them?
Well, some of them have already been affected. It's creating a dilemma for both international and some domestic firms. They try to avoid alienating local protester sympathizers while not running afoul of Beijing, which is usually pretty important to them. And of course, the situation is exacerbated by the power and speed of social media and its blending of fact and fiction, which you've been talking about earlier and yesterday's program. And so if they or their staff especially show support for protesters, they risk alienating consumers in mainland China and vice versa. So then,
and if they have to choose,
that makes it very. Many of them are trying not to, right? Trying to separate what their staff does, for example, as part of their company duties and part of what they do outside. But
Cafe discovered, right? Discovered to their cost that you can't separate staff activities even outside because they were essentially being penalized for staff activities outside working hours, weren't they?
And of course, we're talking about some that are far less visible than Cafe, but still worry about being affected. And if you say if this situation continues for months or even years, how does this affect this kind of dilemma that companies are put into, and how does that affect what they'll think about being in Hong Kong?
I think companies are already having to say to their staff, you don't have to travel to the mainland if you don't want to. If you're worried about what's on your phone or your social media accounts, we're going to have to find someone else to send into the war zone, as it were, or the danger zone, by crossing the boundary. In terms of trying to strike that very difficult balance, just look at what happened with the MTR, which, right. until the 24th of August, they had managed to basically stay politically neutral, even though they are majority owned by the Hong Kong government. They were providing transport in and out of protest areas on their usual schedules. And then the government ordered them to close the Kwantung MTR ahead of an authorised protest.
Well, we have to be careful, though. There's no proof the government ordered that. There was an editorial in the People's Daily a day earlier, and then they then decided. But
let's say they agreed to a request, if you prefer it that way. But they've often referred to requests from the government, and the same with the Airport Express Service, to do various things, like last weekend only run the service probably setting speed records from the Hong Kong station non-stop to the airport and not stopping at the other two stations, Kowloon and Tsing Yi. And with Kwantung, there had been a notice of no objection from the police. There was an authorized protest, and they announced that the stations would close before that even began. And they kept on doing, and that's the point at which they lost the goodwill and became a proxy target for the extremist protesters at the end of these protests. And now they're unfortunately suffering violent consequences.
Do we know anything about the property market? I haven't seen any kind of terribly clear.
Yeah, I think that, finally the Hong Kong government has, with the extradition bill, has come up with an effective cooling measure.
But it's no more than that. It's not.
All the other things they've been doing, slapping stamp duties on left, right, and centre.
Well, there you go then. Time to lift the stamp duty.
Why is it, when they're rolling out $19 billion of handouts and band-aids, that they're not withdrawing the heavy stamp duties on property transactions that are supposed to penalise speculation? I mean, if there's a crisis, then surely the market can't be overheating. It must be the other way around.
That means the property market is not really affected very much.
No, it is. Rents are falling, certainly in commercial areas, because obviously if you're not getting customers in the door for your restaurant, you're going to have to pay lower rent or negotiate with your landlord or quit. So it's clearly damaging retail. And
you yourself just used the word cooling rather than correction. I mean, we've seen huge fluctuations in the Hong Kong property market over the years, and yep. so far, as a result of these protests, the word cooling is the right one that you used. I mean, there has been an effect, but historically, looking at other corrections of the Hong Kong property market, right, it's yes. quite mild so far.
Right, and there's. You know, there's not a huge exodus of people from Hong Kong. They're not queuing up at the
and stock
airport
market, right?
to get the last flight out of Saigon. It's not quite like
stock
that.
Stock market's happily going along. I mean,
Yes, well, on the stock market, you have to remember that two-thirds of the stock market is mainland companies now. So the value of PetroChina or China Mobile or, you know, Tencent is not greatly affected by what happens in Hong Kong. The only thing that affects that to some extent is possibility of capital withdrawal because of from people who are sort of knee-jerk redeeming their mutual funds. They're sitting in the UK or America and saying, I think I shouldn't have this Hong Kong fund anymore. But the bigger effect on the stock market has been the trade war for the last year, basically. And every time things go up or down in the prospects of discussions and meetings and or down in terms of higher tariffs, then the market reacts to that because that really does hurt.
So stock market unaffected by the protests, property market, we're only talking about a relatively mild correction.
But if you don't think it's affecting property prices, then look at the fact that on the day in the afternoon before Carrie Lam held her meeting with the tycoons, and before she then announced to the public what she was doing, formally withdrawing the bill, property stocks in Hong Kong shot up about 8 to 10%. Companies like Wharf, which has the Ocean Terminal and Harbour City complex and Times Square. All the major developers were up 8 to 10% that day. I'm sure that none of the tycoons who were invited to the meeting were insider dealing ahead of that, but clearly someone got wind of what was going to happen, and the market shot up. So there is because of their commercial properties and hotel properties and so forth, there certainly is an impact. But residential, not so much. But you're seeing prices coming off a bit, a few percent here and there, people just waiting and seeing.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit more about the government measures in just a moment. But here's an email from Martin for you, David Webb, which is kind of your home turf, maths. Martin says, interesting to see that David Webb is deep in the yellow camp. He's even not able to condemn the violence. In fact, he takes the same position as Claudia Moe. Violence is transient and just conducted by a small number of people. Instead of acknowledging that it is violence which is destroying the economy...
Oh, it's illegal.
Hang on. Martin says, no wonder he is or was one of the biggest shareholders of Apple Daily. I thought also he's a number guy, but instead he propagates the myth of the 2 million people protested on the 17th of June. Martin says, in average, a protester needs 1 square meter of space. The Connaught Road, Queen's Road and Hennessy Roads are all 23 meters wide. If there would have been ever a march with 2 million people, the march would have been 87 kilometers long. However, the longest route from Victoria Park to Sheung Wan Liaison is at its maximum 6.9 kilometers long. If calculating with one person if calculating with one person per square meter, a length of 6.9 kilometers and maximum width of 23 meters for the Connaught Road, a maximum a maximum of 158,700 people could only fit into this area. Assuming people standing shoulder to shoulder and taking up just half the space, double the amount of people could fit into the same area, i.e. 316,000 people. This is fairly close to the original police estimate of 338,000 people.
Well, you have to remember...
Stop spreading fake news, says Martin.
I respond?
Yes.
First of all, the police estimate is the number of simultaneous people at any of these protests at their height, not the number of people who took part, which many people have finished before others have started in these processions. Secondly, I don't think it really matters whether it was 1 million or 2 million. The point is, it was the biggest protest since 1989. The 9th of June, I was there on the 2003, 2007, 2014. The 9th of June was the biggest turnout I have ever seen in my 28 years in Hong Kong since 1991. I wasn't here during the Tiananmen Square protests in Hong Kong. And Whatever that turnout was.
I was at both.
Okay. So which would you say was larger in terms of...
I'm not in a position to say, because it's really hard to tell.
It doesn't really matter what the absolute numbers are. The point is, if you poll the population on do they trust the Hong Kong judicial system, yes. Do they trust the mainland judicial system, no. By about 5-1 with the mainland judicial system, that's what the extradition bill was about. And then you poll them about do they think Hong Kong should have proper universal suffrage, you're going to get 6-4 or 7-3 in favour of that. So whether they actually come out and march is not really the point. Not everybody can take the day off from their jobs and turn out for these things. It doesn't matter. The point is, we have a democratic deficit in Hong Kong. It's not going away. Yes, you can call me in the yellow camp for that firmly. I believe in freedom, civil liberties, free markets work with freedom of information, freedom of choice. The only choice we don't really have in Hong Kong is the choice of the government that makes the policies that oversee that market. Policies like the ridiculous stamp duties for selling your home within 3 years of buying it, for example. And you know, these policies are generated by an unelected government. When the policies get really bad, like the extradition bill, then we begin to realize that because of measures taken in the last 5 years, LegCo has turned into a rubber stamp parliament. They've screened out various candidates. They've changed the rules of procedure after they've removed legislators from office. They had a majority in the geographic constituencies too for a while, and they've been able to change the rules of procedure to prevent filibustering, and it's become a rubber stamp. And it was only the mass protest, and not even that, but a violent confrontation on the 12th of June that led to Carrie Lam suspending the bill. After the 9th of June, she said, we welcome all points of view and the legislation will proceed on the 12th of June. And so, okay. You know, that is the underlying problem, that we don't have an accountable government. And, you know, but we still have all the civil liberties, all the trappings of a modern democracy, except democracy itself.
Okay, can I just very tentatively add to Martin that your calculations are about people standing still. But of course, this was a procession. There were people moving over a period of hours.
Also,
when it
started
and stopped is very, very hard to say. People are moving. So
people on a lot of different roads. I mean, although only one road.
There were many parallel roads.
What struck me about the 16th of June, that very big protest, was that it was multiple parallel roads packed with people. That was what made it so much bigger than the 9th of June. How many people?
Which I don't remember. From 1989, actually, there being parallel roads like that.
Let's move on, because the questions are continuing to flood in from our listeners for you, David Webb. We've now received an email from a senior police officer who says, please ask David Webb, why should the MTR facilitate rioters who are trying to escape lawful apprehension and suffer the consequences by closing the stations? Suffer the consequences in inverted commas. David Webb?
Well, if they had stayed neutral and facilitated law-abiding protests as exercising their basic law freedoms of assembly and procession, which are spelt out in the basic law, to attend an authorised protest which the police have issued a notice of no objection, if they had carried on doing that and then transporting them home again afterwards, then there perhaps would be much less of this violence, and it wouldn't be directed against the MTR. I mean, remember always
but
that
the
few hundred people who are, have sort of radicalized extremists, I condemn violence. It's illegal. It's not helping the cause at all. They are less than 0.1% of the people who are actually turning out peacefully. And if the Mass Transit Railway Corporation, and it is mass transit, is not transiting people en masse to and from authorised protests, then what kind of reaction do they expect?
But we all know the protesters, the radical protesters, were using the MTR to escape. I saw them myself, to escape from the police. And then they would pop up two stations down the line, and they would do something there. And as soon as the riot police turned up, they'd hop back in.
And there may have been a case. There may have been a case late at night.
It's outside the law. Once you get on a train, you're not home safe.
No, you're certainly not. And there may have been a case for the police asking them to stop a train late at night in order to facilitate arrests. That's not the same thing as shutting down the railway system in advance of an authorised protest, which is what they've started doing after the 24th of August onwards, in response, as Danny pointed out earlier, to critical mainland propaganda saying that the MTR was basically running all of this these protests. They're not. I mean, they're providing a public transport service, and so are the buses. And it's interesting that the bus companies have not withdrawn service, as far as we know.
Well, perhaps they'll be the next target of the People's Daily editorial.
They will, yes. But the MTR didn't cause the extradition bill to be proposed. It didn't cause the protests against the extradition bill. And all it was doing was running a public transport service. And unfortunately, it has now become politicised. And I have sympathy with the police in all of this as well. They have, to some extent, borne the brunt of public anger because for 3 months the government did nothing in response to very large numbers of people peacefully protesting, and the whole situation escalated. If she had withdrawn the bill properly on the 9th of June in response to the first peaceful protest with no violence at all at the end, then we possibly wouldn't have ended up in this situation. Things would have gone back to normal.
I would like to talk a little bit more about the government and sort of, as I say, the mitigation measures in a moment, but just specifically back to David Webb. This is from G, who has a question for Mr. David Webb. While Mr. Webb's majority of net worth is in Hong Kong stocks, but is owned through an offshore BVI company, what are his thoughts about capital restrictions being applied in Hong Kong if the situation gets worse? Should foreigners residing in Hong Kong own stocks with brokers outside Hong Kong?
Well, if you have Hong Kong stocks, however you hold them, you're exposed to the Hong Kong market. And, some of my stocks have been hit. I've got... I won't say the name on your air, but I've got more than 8% of a fashion retailer, which is having a terrible time, and it's going to have to negotiate rent reductions with its landlords and so on. I've got more than 5% of a, I think it's 6 at the moment, of a household products retailer, which has perhaps been less impacted because people still break their saucepans and need replacements. There's an impact for that.
The question is,
could there be capital controls? And the answer is no.
People owning, foreigners residing in Hong Kong owning stocks with brokers outside Hong Kong.
Well, it doesn't matter how they hold them, whether they buy them through an overseas broker or a Hong Kong broker. The question was whether there could be capital controls, and the answer is under the basic law, capital controls are not allowed. We have to maintain an open capital market. Now, could China tear up the basic law earlier than 2047? Yes, it's an act of the National People's Congress that could be repealed. It would breach the treaty with the UK, but I don't think the UK would go to war over that.
They could
then impose capital controls, and that would really ruin the Hong Kong economy.
Okay, there are some more emails about you, for and against, but let me just drag it back. Mark Michelson, what do you think the government should be doing? We had that $19 billion, which didn't seem to make much of an impact. I mean, you know, caught the news for a day or two or something. But what should the administration be doing now? I mean, we've got the introduction of the vacancy tax now. Do you think it's likely that there will be more kind of crowd-pleasing measures like that?
Well, I think one thing the government should do is take advantage of this to deal with some of these serious problems in housing and properties, clearly one of them, as much as they can do, and maybe in cooperation with Beijing as well. So maybe there's an opportunity here. Obviously, communications of some sort or another are very important. That's been one of the major problems. A lot of people just didn't know in terms of the run-up. As David suggested, the extradition bill, there wasn't a lot of consultation going on. This is pretty important for government to engage. Is it possible for them to do so at this point? I think it's not clear, but at least maybe they should try. We've heard them talk about this, but we haven't seen much action in this regard.
But if they want to be bold in economic terms, put aside the politics and communications for a second. What would you do if you were financial secretary? Would you waive rates, waive salary tax? I mean, it just say you have a free hand there. I mean, the government. I know David Webb's got lots of ideas.
Mark, then
we'll go back to
I'm going to let him go. But you know, at the same time, you know, all the reserve land Can we release it? Can we make some of that available, or maybe some other land that's now being held up in various different ways that that the government and others might have power to do this?
The DAB is coming around to that.
Yeah.
Okay, just on that topic, actually, an email from John Calhoun, who says, today's press suggests the government will soon push ahead with a vacancy bill that will penalise developers for hoarding completed flats. Earlier this week, the pro-government DAB accused government of dragging its feet in producing land supply for public housing. The timing of these two news items isn't coincidental. It's clear the Lab administration is under pressure to increase the supply of affordable housing. The four large developers have been sitting on over 100 million square feet of farmland for decades. The government should force them to start building or run the risk of the land reverting to government, who could then use it for low-cost housing. To entice the developers to convert the farmland to apartments, government could set the land premium at a low level and cap the selling price for the flats at a level which gives the developers a decent return, say 20% margin. Government should also force developers to set aside a certain percentage of the flats for low-income households. This would be an astute political move by Lamb, as it would appease the significant numbers of low-income youngsters for whom housing is unaffordable, while concurrently sending a message to the public that the days of cosy ties between government and tycoons are a thing of the past. And a couple of messages, as I say, for David Webb. XC is back, Xiao Chang, who says, David Webb is wrong. The mass protests are principally against his darling capitalism. The terror in Hong Kong is a capitalist terror, not a communist one. People are ground down by property prices and rapacious capital. As said, the cheese is moving. Wake up, David, and smell the cheese.
Well,
and,
I think, you know, we could try
and Guy says, hang on, you've got a compliment coming. Guy says, what an absolute pleasure to have David Webb on Backchat. Would that we had people of his intellect, knowledge, integrity, eloquence, and perceptiveness in the Executive Council and in government.
And David Webb, before you respond, one more on Facebook. It's difficult to top that last comment, but on Facebook, Susan says, David Webb should be chief executive. Now that's left you lost for words for a moment, hasn't it? Right.
On economic measures. Oh, by the way, the mainland has tried outright communism. So if your reader listener would like to go back to, say, North Korea and see how that's working out, China tried it for 30 years until 1979. Didn't go too well. So did the USSR until 1989. Didn't work too well. You do actually have to have income inequality in order to provide opportunity. What's important is that people have that opportunity, social mobility, education, and so on, and the ability to do their best. Now, to be rewarded for it. Government policies, well, I mean, one huge positive would be if Beijing, the Hong Kong government, was to advise Beijing that we've only got 27 years and 9 months left until the promises in the Basic Law expire. It's getting a little bit short-dated. And could they please give us 50 years' notice of any change to the policies promised in the Basic Law, including maintaining Hong Kong's capitalist and system and freedoms? Because otherwise that short time frame is going to get shorter. In 3 years' time, if you take out a 25-year mortgage, it will finish after the promises expire in 2047. You know, if you're thinking of studying Hong Kong law and you're a 21-year-old graduate, then in 27 years' time, you'll be 48 and there may not be a Hong Kong law to practice. So you might like to know if that's going to continue. So, you know, whatever the current debate is, we are starting to run down the clock and people are going to get more nervous about the future as we get closer to that time, unless there are some promises from Beijing to give us either a 50-year notice or just to add on another 50 years to our current system, and hope that by then at least the mainland will have converged with it and become an open and prosperous democracy itself, and given Hong Kong democracy in the meantime.
It's not stopping people studying Hong Kong law at the moment, David Webb.
Maybe they're a little bit short-sighted about it, because it could well expire. In terms of an earlier comment on universities, I agree. We need to expand them. We already have a lot of mainland students in our universities, and they're learning about civil liberties and the way of life in Hong Kong. And it would help if we were to double the number of places, so that we still had enough places for Hong Kong citizens, and increased Hong Kong's role as a centre of excellence for education. That some of our universities do rank very highly on international scores. So on budget measures, let's abolish stamp duty. I mean, let's just stop taxing people for moving their assets around. They're not making a profit or a loss necessarily. They could be doing either. They could have genuine reasons for moving across town. So why do we slap a tax on them just for moving and increase the price of housing for first-time buyers by charging them that stamp duty?
All right, can I finish with a really dumb question for both of you? Mark, I mean, how optimistic are you feeling about the economy? How do you feel about the economy in the medium term?
Well, in the medium term, I think it's going to be tough, but I still have confidence in our economy and our position, and I think a lot of companies do too, because they look around and what are the alternatives to Hong Kong? Hong Kong, even under this situation, looks better than most. Now, it could deteriorate. There could be problems.
Singapore's got economic problems, haven't they?
They are having serious
Singapore's
economic problems.
Singapore's in recession.
Having serious economic problems. So, you know, a lot of the alternatives for a lot of reasons don't look so good. So I think we can get through this, but we have a lot of challenges, a lot of which aren't related to what we've been talking about today.
David Webb, how are you feeling about the medium term?
Well, I'm a long-term optimist. I'll be 82 in 2047. Yeah. I think by then China will be an open, prosperous democracy because its people won't accept stagnation of their economic incomes for very long. At some point, either there'll have to be top-down reform in China or bottom-up revolution, and one way or the other, they'll come out of it with a much more free and liberal society, and Hong Kong will benefit from that.
All right, just a couple of emails. Thank you very much indeed to finish off. One from the original G, who says, with the subject line, stupid questions. A thief gets on the MTR with police in pursuit. Stupid questioner thinks the MTR should stop so the thief can be arrested. Listed companies in Hong Kong are incorporated in the Cayman Islands. Let's stop people investing in them. Truly, events have turned people stupid. And Elliot says, the police on the MTR, the police refer to their actions against protesters as clearance operations. They've conducted these operations against both violent and non-violent protesters. The 12th of June on Harcourt Road was an example of this. If the MTR does not operate, then how are people supposed to comply with police instructions to clear an area? Asks Elliot. Thank you very much indeed for that. I think that's all the emails for today. Thank you to our guest, to David Webb, a shareholder activist, founder of website.com, that's with two B's, and to Mark Michelson, Chairman Asia CEO Forum at IMA Asia, and to Danny, of course, as well, our co-host today, and to our new producer, Michelle. Thank you very much indeed.